You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, here today for Leonard Lopate. Tony Duff, a young, aspiring journalist turned hedge fund trader, spent 15 years in the financial industry, and during that time, he became obsessed with money, addicted to drugs, observed slippery deals being done by his boss, Rajaratnam, at Galleon, and saw Wall Street crack, then crumble before his eyes. He tells the story of his tumultuous career on Wall Street in The Buy Side, a Wall Street trader's tale of spectacular excess. It's published by Crown Business, and I'm happy it brings Tony Duff to the Leonard Lopate Show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so why'd you get into that tawdry business of the financial business?
You know, it was by accident, and I literally moved to the city in 94 from a small town in Maine, Kennebunk, Maine. And I was very naive, and I literally went to Sports Illustrated to knock on the door to try and get a job. And I had no clue on how to get a job. And I ended up calling my uncle who worked on Wall Street, not to get a job on Wall Street, but just figured he knew influential people and whatnot. And next thing I know, I'm sitting at Lehman Brothers, and I'm looking at all these late 20, early 30-year-old men and women dressed very nicely, commanding a lot of, you know, respect, and it looked so sexy, and I was like, I want in. I don't know what they're doing, but I want in.
So that was your first impression of Wall Street.
Yes.
Young, sexy, vibrant.
Money.
Money.
Right.
That was the overriding issue for you.
That's I needed a job, and I saw the lifestyle, and it looked sexy.
Now, you saw that at Lehman Brothers.
That was my first interview.
Your first interview. But you then ended up at Morgan Stanley. How'd you land that job?
I was on the trading desk, and I was at the point where the manager was about to say, you know, all right, give me your resume and we'll keep in touch. And this woman from a different department who knew my uncle said, hey, come on up to my office. And we were talking and going back and forth, and she happened to have missed the night before episode of Melrose Place. And conveniently, I had seen,
you had seen it.
I had seen the episode, and 24 hours later, I had a job.
That's spectacular. So, what questions aside from the Melrose Place question? Were there other questions that they asked you during this interview that struck you as?
Well, this is 1994, mm-hmm. So I'm sure it's different today. It is different today, but I distinctively remember never being asked a question that might qualify me for a job in finance. And as the years went on, I kind of figured it out. It was more about, I mean, you're sitting next to guys probably the same distance as you and I, right? Mm-hmm. And so you want to sit next to someone that you like all day, every day. And so it was more of a sort of personality interview than anything else.
Did they make you take one of those, what is it called, those Briggs personality test things?
No, never. I mean, I've heard that, but no. I never did.
So was your initial position was with Private Client Services?
Yes.
The Private Client Services branch. What did that entail?
Well, I was a sales assistant, so, you know, it was like a step up from a temp or a secretary. And it was administrative, but I got my license, and I learned the business, and we sold every product. So it was a great place to start. But I quickly realized that the guy to the right of me had a Harvard MBA, and the guy to the left of me, you know, went to Stanford, and the guy across from me went to Duke. So I had to figure out my own niche if I was going to be successful. And when the office lights went out and I was at happy hour, that's when I was in my element, and I said, aha.
That's when you realized social,
yes,
actually having social skills,
yeah,
was something that could trump Harvard, Stanford,
yeah,
and all those. And Duke, you mentioned all those fancy pants MBAs that were surrounding you.
Well, yeah, and you know, and I guess it adds to the debate of, you know, IQ versus EQ. I have no idea what my IQ is. I'm going to guess it's average, but EQ, you know, I can walk into a room, and I know immediately, do I go in hot? Do I go in cold? You know, do I play hard? I just know the temperature or the emotional temperature of the room as I walk into it.
So going in hot is, how does that?
You know, if someone needs to be, you know, clubbed over the head and force fed, you know, like you have to buy this,
I see.
You know, or you know, it's a game.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you How did you use those social skills to your benefit?
Basically, you know, and it sounds very disingenuous, and I'd like to think that I wasn't, but it was the ability to get people to like you. And people are, on Wall Street in all walks of life are more willing to help you if they like you or you can get along with them. And, you know, when I was the head trader at, you know, Argus and J.L. Berkowitz, you have 50 to 100 sales traders covering you all day. They don't all have the same skill set. So I knew how to work with it. Let's say you were great at technical analysis. If I'm trying to squeeze you for something else, it's not going to work. But I know what you're good at, and I know how to work that relationship to maximize to benefit both of us.
Mm-hmm. So in 95, when you were at Morgan Stanley, everybody got access to the internet.
Yes.
And how did that change things?
You know, it sped the world up. It sped Wall Street up. You know, trade started settling faster, and you could send an email now, or a mass email, and the information sped up so fast that guys who had 10, 15 years experience on me, it sort of leveled the playing field a little bit.
And so did it go from, you went from hours to minutes or from minutes to seconds in terms of the world speeding up?
Probably hours to seconds. It was dramatic.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Turney Duff about his new book, The Buy Side, A Wall Street Trader's Tale of Spectacular Excess, published by Crown Business. So you then left Morgan Stanley for the Galleon Group.
I did.
And what was this new position with Galleon?
I went in as, you know, sort of an assistant trader, and the desk was small. At the time I went to Galleon, we were about $700 million. And 2 years later when I left, it was $5 billion. So I got to witness, you know, some crazy, crazy years in expansion. But the first job was just assistant trader, hitting the phones, booking trades, and just making sure I didn't get fired that day.
Uh-huh. Was that always a constant threat of being fired?
Yes.
Every day?
It was considered a great day if I didn't get fired.
So at one point you were on the buy side of a hedge fund. So what exactly does that mean to be on the buy side?
Sure. Basically, on Wall Street, you have the sell side and the buy side. And the buy side is considered the client. So all hedge funds are the buy side. Mutual funds, pension funds, they are the client. And they're the ones calling Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. And they are the ones who are selling research, their trade facilitation, you know, getting meetings, whatever you need. So it just meant that I was a client of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and so when you're the client,
well, yeah. So
then the doors open. Anything you want to
pretty much, yeah.
Try to get your business. And so then why does being on the buy side end up being sort of the magic key to the luxury of Wall Street?
You know, let's jump back to like 2002, 2003. I'm 32, 33 years old. And the hedge fund I'm the head trader of and partner of is over $1 billion. And we are paying the street in commissions between $30 and $50 million a year. So I am responsible for paying the street $30 to $50 million. Every single person on Wall Street wants a piece of that pie.
Mm-hmm.
So when I have an order, let's say, buy 1 million shares of IBM, I can call 100 different guys. They all want me to call them. And so whether it be research or facilitation or the guy took me to the Knicks game last night or flew me on a private jet to the Super Bowl or maybe there was an escort involved, like, who knows? But people are trying to get my business.
They will do anything. Clearly, if an escort's involved, they will do anything to get your business.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so being on the buy side, what was the typical day and the typical night like?
The day, you know, I would get in and between 6 and 6:30 and kind of find out what was going on overseas and, you know, get up to speed. And we would have a morning meeting and have a game plan for that day. And, of course, that month and that year. But you game plan for that day and decide what are you going to buy, what are you going to sell, how are you going to do it. But it's a minute by minute, you know, you're changing your mind every minute depending on what news comes in. And so all day I'm just trading all day, every day. making sure that there are no errors or mistakes. And as soon as the office lights go out,
At what time? The office lights go out at what time?
You know, it's these damn kids who, you know, started getting all, like, aggressive and getting internships. Sometime in the late 90s, you had these high school kids and college kids getting these internships. And, you know, we used to leave at 4 o'clock, and all of a sudden now we're leaving at 5, and we're bitter. But I know, right? It's crazy.
But getting in at what time?
You know, it was like a 6 to 4 job originally, okay. And then, you know, kept getting
10-hour
more
day.
And more competitive, mm-hmm. And they were willing to work for less. And, you know, like, what are you doing? But, you know, I would say 3-4 nights a week I was out with people from the South Side, you know, maybe just going to a restaurant, maybe going to a bar, maybe to a game or a concert or whatever. And then, you know, the other nights I was still socializing with my non-Wall Street friends. But the nighttime started pretty much right after the closing bell.
And so you never had to pay for anything?
For the most part, no.
Like nothing, not a meal, not a drink, not a... Were gifts involved? Like, did someone say, hey, here's this nice Cartier watch, or here's this nice case of Chateau Neuf de Pop from whatever year,
yeah, there's,
for you?
There's a chapter in the book, I think it's December of 2003, and I'm in my apartment down at Tribeca, and I'm by myself, and, you know, I start unwrapping gifts, and there was probably like 13 or 14 from the sell side, and, you know, it was a case of champagne, a case of Patron Silver. I got a TiVo. Like, TiVo was, like, brand new in, you know, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
I got a night at the Thompson Hotel. Like, yeah.
This is all in all in 1 month. Well, I mean, December's bonus time, too. So I can imagine.
It is.
So Galleon Group was founded by, as I said before, Roger Ratnam, who, as some might know, was convicted of insider trading in 2011. How close were you to him during your time at Galleon?
You know, I sat probably 5 feet from him. We didn't socialize outside of work unless it was a big event. He was very friendly, very bubbly, very generous. But in the office, he also sort of had this sort of mystique. You know, you didn't want to upset him. But yeah, it was, I mean, I worked 5 feet from him. So, mm-hmm. You know.
And so what was the Admiral account?
I'm surprised more people haven't brought this up.
I'm bringing it up now.
No, thankfully, right? No, it was a fund that was part of Galleon, and it was primarily Raj's money and other partners, myself included. When I first started at Galleon, they said, hey, put your money in the Admiral's account. And I was like, I don't have any money. And they're like, just put your money in there. And I was like, okay.
A certain amount of money or
no,
just all of your money?
You could, yeah.
Anything you could.
My IRA was in there and then, you know, whatever I could scrounge together.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, this isn't foolproof because it's impossible with the market, you know, changing every single day. But a lot of winners, like trade winners, were going into this fund. And so the performance for the partners and the employees' money was much more significant than, you know, the main fund where investors had their money. And there's a story or an anecdote in the book where we actually got about $8 million from an IPO from Credit Suisse First Boston. And with a little, you know, smoke and mirrors, we were able to make it look like the shares were put into the main fund. But the profit ended up in the Admiral's account, which I'm not proud of any of that behavior, and I take full responsibility for what I did. But it was just important to be in the book, not because I'm pointing the finger or, you know, telling on them. It was a moment in time where I'm 29 years old, and there was some innocence left of that, you know, boy from a small town in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to put more importance on money and greed and power than the things that my parents taught me growing up with, you know, integrity and honor and so.
And the Nortel trade, what was that?
That was, you know, I called it in the book the $1 billion flip. Raj got a call, got pulled into an analyst's office, door was closed, and then 15 minutes later, we were literally selling every single position. So we were flat on the day. We didn't own any stocks. And then 15 minutes later, we went in and we shorted everything, which is, you know, a negative bet on the market. And at the end of the day, 15 minutes later, Nortel pre-announced, had negative forecasts out, you know, outlook, and the market was down, I don't know, 5, 7, 10% the next day. And we just made a killing. And I was just like, oh, my God, like this is how it works.
And so, I mean, I'm not in finance or Wall Street, but does that count as insider trading?
Yes.
And you had all this information and knowledge. And in addition to the smoke and mirrors you did with the Admiral account, you were able to use this information to the other folks involved to enrich yourselves.
Yes. Yes. 100%. And the thing is, you know, I didn't have the courage to stand up and say, oh, this is wrong. And I didn't know for sure what was said in the meeting. But it was very sort of eye-opening.
So, I mean, clearly you talk about the greed and you know, making money for money's sake, and not just making money. I mean, you made millions of dollars, right, and as much as you could. How much money? What was the most amount of money you've made in a year working on Wall Street?
There's a chapter in the book, and my biggest year was close to $2 million.
I'm sorry, there was a silence. I mean, I would love to make $2 million, and that's over the course of a year, or was that
was total comp in 1 year?
Total comp in 1 year, and that's your compensation. Stuff that you made in various accounts?
No. That was just bonus and salary.
Bonus and salary.
Right.
So then what was your – so if $2 million was the most you've made, then your net worth, is that – how much was that?
I don't know. But at one point I made $1 million investment into a franchise called Fatburger. You know, I bought a $2 million home out in Huntington Bay, Long Island, and I had money in the bank. But I don't know what my highest net worth ever was.
I know. It's more than mine. That much I know. So in addition to being addicted to making money, you were also addicted to cocaine.
Yes.
And how did that happen?
The first time I was offered cocaine, the very first thought I had in my head was Len Bias. Don't do cocaine.
The basketball player.
Yes.
A college basketball player who died.
Like 86 maybe?
Right. And it was his first time apparently using cocaine.
Yeah. And the second thought was Don Johnson's going to knock on the door and blast a few bullet holes from Miami Vice. You know, like, and so I didn't do it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 9 months later, my bank account had changed, my lifestyle had changed, and it was offered to me again. And it didn't seem so menacing. And cocaine is something that I thought I would never do, and I did it, and it was the greatest feeling ever.
And you did it because, I mean, cocaine, I suppose, is all over the place on Wall Street. I mean, it's not like you could avoid it.
Yeah, I could have avoided it.
You mean you could have, but I guess
it
a long
right.
way around.
It felt right.
So how prevalent, I guess the question is, how prevalent is cocaine use on Wall Street?
It's definitely there. It is part of the culture. But I can tell you that every firm that I worked at, I was always hiding my cocaine use. So it's not out in the open.
It's not flagrantly
right.
open.
Like, I wouldn't be doing lines on the desk.
I would hope not. But can you talk about the White House? What was the White House? We're not talking about the place where President Obama lives.
So in the book, I talk about this place called the White House where it was a group of sales traders, or the sell side of Wall Street, and it was pretty much a place for me to go, whether it was cocaine or escorts or just party, whatever I wanted to do. And it was pretty much open all the time, and it was sort of a entertaining spot. And you know, I got sucked in, and you know, so I could go there and I could do my cocaine and, you know, or call an escort or whatever and hang out and party.
And so when did you realize that you first realized you were addicted?
The very first time I did it, I said to myself, oh, my God, this is too good. Like, it's going to be a problem at some point. And I kept drawing these lines. I'm like, well, I just won't take the dealer's number. And so, you know, like I would go a year or two, you know, never having a dealer's number. And, of course, then I got the dealer's number. And then I found out that my girlfriend was pregnant. And I was like, oh, this is going to save me. And fell right back into it. And then my daughter was born. I said, okay, now I'm a father. And I could never stop.
And so when did you, you've gone into rehab twice?
Twice.
So when did you go into rehab the first time? And what compelled you to go?
It was October of 2006. My daughter had just turned one. I had tried to get clean that spring earlier, and I said to myself, well, you know, I know I can't do cocaine, but I'll go back to drinking. And after two drinks, I no control, and I, you know, would end up getting cocaine. And I just made so many excuses with work that it got to the point where, you know, I told them I had West Nile virus, SARS, pink eye. A friend tried to commit suicide. I'd flooded my apartment. I'd called in sick and made so many excuses that I was on the corner of 54th and Park. And if I went to work, I would be fired. And if I called in sick, I would be fired. So I saw this huge puddle. And I decided I was going to fake a mugging. So I end up repeatedly throwing my body into this puddle on the pavement. And, you know, my hands weren't, like, burnt enough, and my shirt wasn't soaked enough. My pants weren't ripped. And so I just kept going, boom, 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 throwing myself into this puddle.
And what time of day is this?
About 6 a.m.
6 a.m.
And I go into work, and obviously they, you know, they know what's up. And, you know, 48 hours later, I was on a plane to rehab.
So a month after you got out of rehab, you went back to – you came back to Wall Street. Was it hard to get hired again?
Seemingly, I thought I had a scarlet letter A for addict on my chest coming back to Wall Street. It was so easy to get a job. I mean, I had tons and tons of offers.
I mean, they knew you'd been in rehab.
I mean, I didn't go into the interviews, you know, saying,
"Hey, I'm just back."
Right. I didn't do that, but it's a small world, so I'm assuming that most of them knew.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's good and bad. I mean, it's good that, you know, if they were doing it out of, hey, let's give this guy a second chance, then that's good. If they were doing it like, hey, this guy can help us make a lot of money, that's bad.
Mm-hmm. And then you had a relapse.
Yeah.
And started using cocaine again. What happened there?
I knew I was an addict and an alcoholic, so I knew I couldn't just have one line or one drink, but I had this genius idea. I said, well, why don't you have one relapse? So I planned the whole night, you know, called my girlfriend and, you know, said goodnight to my daughter, got a hotel room, a pile of blow, you know, on-demand porn, a couple of bottles, and just, you know.
Bottles of
alcohol, mini bar,
gin,
whatever.
Vodka,
doesn't really matter, does it?
Really, no, it doesn't. Go on, sorry.
And so I said to myself, I'm just going to blow it out. Because I knew that I'm an addict. And so I had this big night by myself, very, very sad. But at the time, I thought I was in heaven or thought I was happy. And so about 12 hours later, I said to myself, all right, well, I can do that once a quarter. And then probably 12 hours after that, I was like, well, I can do that once a month. And 2 weeks later, I rented a hotel room, did the same thing. And then the next week, I was up to one... doing it once a week within a month, and then I was right back to where I was.
And then you got fired.
Well, I mean, yeah, sort of. I went back to rehab. It was ironically, on the same day Raj Rajaratnam got arrested, October 16, 2009, I'd been up for 3 days. I'm standing out half naked on my porch out in Huntington Bay, and I called up my boss and said, I can't make it in today, and I kind of mumbled, or ever, and that was my last bottom.
It's hard to believe we have run out of time, but I cannot let you go without asking you this question. Given everything we just talked about, everything you just lived through, what tips would you give MBA students, folks coming out of school and looking to get a job on Wall Street? What would you tell them to do or not to do?
You know, I probably first and foremost would say, you know, make sure that your moral compass is in check and that you are acting the way that you believe you should, just as a human being. And at the end of the day, you know, I spent 15 years trying to fill this void with drugs, sex, money, power, and I just kept trying to fill it. And no matter what I did, I couldn't ever be content. And so I think it's really important to sort of figure out what is going to make you fulfilled. And if the answer is just money, drugs, sex, and women, then good luck. But, you know, for me, I had to figure out, like, how do I become a better person? And the exterior things, the big house, the hot girlfriend, you know, the cars, the money, that didn't do it for me. And if I made $2 million, I wanted to make three.
And are you content now, right now, as you speak?
I have never been happier. I'm living in the first floor of a split-level house. I have no money in the bank. I'm co-parenting my daughter, and I write every day, and I've never been happier.
I've been speaking with Turney Duff about his book, The Buy Side, A Wall Street Trader's Tale of Spectacular Excess. It's published by Crown Business. Turney, thanks so much
for
coming in.
Appreciate it.